dream as someone else. I never told my parents because I knew they wished for me to train as a warrior and eventually be named to Auron's council. But I told my Aunt Delia. Auron's mother, Laura thought. The queen. My aunt believed that the surest way to earn trust was to give it. Taryn pulled on Laura's arm, stopping her to allow something to slither across their path before carrying on. Everyone supported the treaty to end the war with Maradrina, but no one supported the inclusion of a marriage clause. No one wanted Auron to marry an outsider, especially a Maradrinian. But Aunt Delia believed it was the only way for us to ever have peace with our neighbors. The only way for people to stop seeing an enemy when we sat across the table to trade.
It's a lie, Saren's voice shrieked inside Laura's head. Using kindness to get you to reveal what you should not.
But Laura shuddered the voice. If she believed this marriage would stop Maradrinians from viewing Ithacana as an enemy, she was mistaken. Taryn shook her head.
She didn't want to change your kingdom's beliefs. She wanted to change ours.
No more could be said. As they had reached Nana's home, the old woman standing in the doorway watching them approach.
The wayward children return.
We kept busy, Nana.
Busy drinking from the smell of it.
A somewhat hypocritical comment, given Laura could smell alcohol on the woman's breath, a bottle and a half-filled glass sitting on the table behind her.
I'm off to bed, Laura said, in no mood to be berated.
But Nana caught Laura's arm in an iron grip. With the other hand, she held out a bag that twitched and squeaked.
First, you feed the snakes.
Laura eyed the bag with distaste, not because she had any particular aversion to mice, but because she was sick of the old witch ordering her about like a servant. What she wanted to do was sneak out tonight to have a look at the bridge pier, but Nana probably intended to sit up watching her.
No.
Nana's eyebrows rose.
No. Is the little princess too good to feed an old woman's pets?
Laura's fingers tightened reflexively. Then her eyes lighted upon the shelves above the snake cages, and an idea began to form.
I'm afraid of mice, she lied, flinching away from the bag as Nana swung it in her direction.
Get over it.
Laura was forced to catch the bag, or have the mice scatter everywhere. Silently cursing the old woman, Laura plucked a mouse out of the bag by its tail, carefully unlatched one of the cages and tossed the creature inside, before moving on to the next. The snakes were all poisonous. Taryn had told her that Nana harvested their venom and used it to create antidotes, as well as medicines for various natural afflictions. There were dozens of vials of foggy liquid stored above the cages, and above those, countless more plants and remedies, all clearly labeled. Between each cage, Laura scanned the contents, smiling when she found what she was looking for. Dropping the still wriggling bag of mice, Laura shrieked,
It bit me! Which snake?
Not a snake! She stuck one of her fingers into her mouth, biting down to create a realistic injury.
A mouse! Damn it, girl!
Nana snatched up the bag, but it was too late. The remaining mice were running every which way.
Taryn, catch the damn things before they get into my larder!
Laura wailed, climbing onto a chair while the rodents took advantage of their freedom. But the second Nana's back was turned, she snatched a small jar from the shelves.
Catch them! Catch them!
Taryn was dutifully chasing after the mice, but she'd drank enough that night that her movements were too slow. The rodents dodging easily until she turned to stomping on them with her heavy boots. Laura took the moment to uncork the jar.
Don't kill them!
Nana had two mice by the tail and was shoving them into the bag.
The snakes won't eat them if they're dead.
She lunged for another mouse, and Laura leaned sideways and dumped a generous splash of the jar's contents into Nana's cup, once again grateful for the Ithacanian preference for strong drink.
Got one!
Taryn tossed the mouse into Nana's sack. Laura corked the vial and shoved it back in its place on the shelf, then stood on her chair, watching, uselessly, as the two women collected the remaining mice.
Muttering under her breath, Nana proceeded to finish feeding the snakes. Then she grabbed hold of Laura's hand, examining the tiny bleeding wound.
Idiot! We'll serve you right if it festers.
Jerking her hand out of the old woman's grip, Laura glared at her.
I'm going to bed.
Her boots thudded imperiously as she made her way over to the cot that had been made up for her. And she curbed a smile as, from the corner of her eye, she watched Nana down the contents of her cup. Now, to wait. Not an hour later, the home dark. Nana's groans split the silence. A moment later, the old woman climbed from her bed and staggered out the door. On her feet in a flash, Laura went to the wall of vials, plucking up one she'd noticed earlier. Measuring out a drop, she held it beneath Taryn's nostril, silently apologizing for the headache it would cause in the morning, as the gently snoring woman snorted it up. Laura stepped outside into a pool of lantern light. A gentle breeze tugged at her hair, smelling of jungle and rain, the stars overhead only visible in patches through the growing cloud cover. Laura took the lantern, turned the flame up as high as it would go, then strode toward the small outbuilding where the toilet was located. Stopping outside, she smirked at the sounds coming from within, then rotated in a circle, peering into the darkness. As predicted, a tall Ithaconian man appeared.
Is there something I can help you with, Your Grace?
He hooked his thumb on his belt as he eyed her.
Oh! Laura jumped, then pressed a hand to her mouth as though startled. Well, I needed to...
She gestured at the building, right as a tremendous fart reverberated from within, followed up by a groan of dismay. Laura might be out of her element in Ithacana, but when it came to narcotics, she was right at home. Nana was exactly where she expected her to be. The guard's eyes widened in the lantern light.
Right.
He was obviously trying not to laugh.
I see. Well, perhaps you could...
A bush will do.
Laura pushed the lantern at him.
Can you hold this for me?
Relieving herself behind the cover of a tree, Laura returned to the guard and retrieved the lantern. Holding it up, she marked how he squinted and blinked from the brightness.
Do you suppose she'll be all right?
Laura gestured to the outhouse. Do you think we should...
No.
The thought of interrupting Nana in the toilet was clearly not something he cared to risk.
I'm sure she'll be fine.
I hope so.
Laura gave him a winning smile, then retreated to the house. Nana would be shitting for hours, but she'd be fine come morning. Snuffing the lantern, she hung it on the hook and went inside. But she didn't shut the door all the way. Counting to five, she eased it back open, greeted by nothing but blackness. Her eyes hadn't adjusted from the brilliant light of the lantern, but that meant neither would have the guards. Moving blind, Laura edged around the corner of the house, where she waited until she could make out the shadows of the trees. Then she dropped to the ground, crawling silently next to Nana's garden wall until she was in the jungle. The trees on this island weren't nearly as thick as they were on midwatch, faint moon and starlight filtering through the leaves and allowing Laura to move at a slow trot up the path toward the bridge pier. Any sound she made was covered by the ocean breeze, but she paused occasionally to listen for sounds of pursuit. There were none. The faint scent of wet rock drifted over her nose, strange and yet familiar. And after a heartbeat, Laura recognized it as the unique odor of the bridge stone. Moving more cautiously, lest there be guards, she crept up the path until, through the trees, she made out the large shadow of the pier rising up into the night. A shadow that spread out north and south. The bridge. Picking her way through the trees, Laura searched for any sign of a guard. But there was none. So she made her way to the base of the pier. It was constructed from the combination of a natural rock outcropping and bridge stone, and it held the bridge perhaps 20 feet above the ground. The terrain around it was rocky, so there was no obvious path leading to the entrance she knew was there. Laura ran her fingernail against the expanse of bridge stone that made up the pier, searching the base for the outline of the door. But she soon gave up. There were too many scratches and marks, and she didn't have that much time. So she resorted to pushing on the surface, throwing her weight against the stone in the hopes it would open. Nothing. Swearing, Laura went to the part of the pier that was natural stone. Kicking off her heavy boots and tucking them into a shadow, she started climbing. Higher and higher she rose, back and shoulders burning from the effort. She reached the bottom of the bridge, feeling along the side of it, and smiling as she found linear striations in the stone that provided just enough handholds for her to climb. Her fingers screaming at her, Laura scrambled up the side of the bridge, rolling onto the top. Darkness spread out beneath her, in an endless sea of night, only a few pinpricks of light from the island's interior breaking the velvety blackness. Moving slowly, Laura trailed her fingers down the middle of the bridge, knowing that she'd eventually find a mile marker twin to the one inside. Sweat dribbled down her back, her internal clock telling her that she needed to get back to Nana's house, but she pressed on until she found it. Then she strode back to the pier, counting her carefully measured paces, only to hear voices coming from the opposite direction.
Goddamn idiots! What were they thinking, parking a whole merchant party above Gamayr for the night?
It was Jor. He and who knew how many others were on top of the bridge with her. Heart thudding, Laura dropped to her stomach, crawling to the edge and peering over. Below, a group exited from the trees, one of them carrying a jar of a faintly glowing substance. They don't know they're above Gamayr, Jor. Leah's voice. That's the whole damn point.
Doesn't make it less of a pain in our asses.
Laura rolled to the opposite edge from the party below, then carefully lowered herself down the side, her sweating fingers quivering from the effort.
Are you two about finished up there?
Arryn's voice. One of Laura's hands slipped, and she gasped, dangling from one hand until she regained her grip.
We had a look. There's a merchant party, camped for the night right below us. And the topside hatch is too close for us to enter undetected. It's a 3-mile walk either direction to the next hatch, and with those winds blowing in, I wouldn't advise it. No one is looking to spend the night tied to the bridge top in the pouring rain.
Arryn let out a weary sigh.
By boat it is, then. And rough waters. I hope whatever Nana gave your lovely bride will settle her stomach enough for the journey, though something strong might be in order to deal with her damned panic. Leave Laura alone. She was raised in the desert, and she can't swim. Falling in the water is a valid fear. Yeah, yeah.
Laura used the sound to clamber down further. When she was 10 feet from the bottom, she jumped, her bare feet making only the faintest slap as she hit the ground and rolled, taking 5 long steps until she was out of sight in the trees. Mud squished between her toes as she circled around, watching as Arryn rested his hands against the pier, one above the other, and pressed twice. A faint click, and a panel of rocks swung open. He went inside. Above, Jor and Leah had looped a rope through one of the many rings embedded in the bridge, and were climbing down the pier side by side. Leah was pulling the rope through the loop when Arryn reemerged and said,
There's someone sleeping right against the bloody door. Like I said, Jor replied. Idiots. It is what it is. Let's go.
Arryn started down the path toward Nana's home. To retrieve her, she realized. Shit. Laura waited until the others had followed before creeping up to the pier to retrieve her boots from their hiding place. It was going to be a mad dash to get back to Nana's ahead of them undetected, but she couldn't leave without having a look inside. Pressing her hands twice in the same spot Arryn had, Laura grinned as the door swung open. She'd expected it to be entirely dark inside, but the curved stairs leading upward were illuminated by more glowing jars. Taking the steps 3 at a time, she reached a smooth stone wall. Knowing there was a risk of being caught, but judging it worth the reward, she pressed her hands against it twice. Click! She winced at the sound, then eased the door open a crack, the heavy block moving on silent hinges. There was indeed a man sleeping in front of it, his snores likely all that had kept the masked Ithaconian soldiers sitting guard inside from hearing the noise. The doorway needed to be marked so her father's soldiers could find it from the inside. Yet she knew the Ithaconians swept the bridge for any signs of tampering, so it had to be something they wouldn't notice. Her mind raced through the years of Saren's lessons, knowing she needed a solution and that it needed to present itself immediately, or Auron was going to reach Nana's before her and find her missing. An idea sprung into her thoughts. Pulling out her knife, Laura sliced open a shallow wound on her forearm, then tucked away the blade. Covering her fingers in blood, she carefully traced the outer rim of the door. Once dry, it wouldn't be noticeable against the stone, but if sprayed with the right compound, it would react. There was no time to do anything else. Carefully closing the door, Laura flew down the stairs and pushed the door in the base shut. Then she was running as fast as she dared, her bare feet scraping against roots and rocks. But she couldn't move this swiftly in her heavy Ithaconian boots while maintaining any level of silence. Ahead, she picked out the faint glow of the jar Auron carried, and she slowed her speed, moving up as close behind them as she dared. She considered trying to pass them in the trees, but there was no chance of them not hearing her, not in the dark at this pace. Nana's house appeared ahead. Think of a plan, she silently screamed at herself even as she watched Auron round the house. Open the door. He was back out in a flash, shouting, "Where is she?" Tugging on her boots, Laura cut into the trees, then stepped out into the clearing, walking through it toward Auron. "I'm right here, so quit yelling." He stared at her, as did his bodyguard and the guard tasked with watching the house. Nana chose that moment to fling open the door to the outhouse, clad only in a nightdress and boots.
"What are you doing wandering the woods in the middle of the night?"
Saren's voice echoed through her head. "Most people lie to avoid embarrassment. Very few people lie to embarrass themselves, which inclines others to believe them." Laura looked at the ground, knowing that the sweat running down her face and her ruddy complexion would only add truth to the lie.
"I wasn't feeling well, and the facilities were," she gestured at Nana,
"occupied." Auron turned to his grandmother.
"Are you ill?"
"The shits. I'll live."
"It must have been something we ate."
Laura pressed a hand to her stomach as though it pained her. "Or perhaps some filth on those mice you made me touch."
"Mice? You made her feed your snakes?"
Shaking his head, Auron rounded on the guard.
"Where the hell were you?"
"Here, I didn't see her leave. I was watching."
"Not very well."
"I was trying to be discreet."
Laura kicked the toe of her boot into the dirt.
"Now, if you're all finished gaping at me, I'd like to go back to sleep."
Auron exhaled a long breath.
"What?"
Laura folded her arms under her breasts and looked up at him.
"A fleet of 30 Amaridian ships is lurking off Ithaconus coast. There's a squall blowing in that might buy us some time, but Midwatch is under my command, and I need to get back to prepare our defenses."
"They intend to raid?"
"Likely."
He exhaled a long breath.
"You can come back with us or stay here with Nana for war tides. Your choice."
"I'll go back to Midwatch."
There was no bloody way in hell she was spending another day with that awful woman. Never mind that judging from Nana's narrow-eyed expression, the old woman wasn't entirely fooled by her deception. No doubt she'd tie Laura to the bed every night and triple her guard. And because she needed to step forward with her plan to lure Auron in, Laura added,
"I want to go with you."
His brow furrowed and he glanced away.
"We can't go through the bridge. There's a merchant party on their way to Southwatch camped above this pier for the night, and we can't get in without them seeing. It will have to be by boat."
Laura swallowed the unease that burned in her stomach, hearing the rising winds.
"Control your fear," she commanded. "There is much to be gained here if you keep your wits about you."
"I'll manage." Auron turned on Taryn, who was rubbing her temples.
"Not your finest hour, soldier. Jor will deal with your punishment once we're home."
"Sorry, Your Grace."
Guilt briefly rose in Laura before she swallowed it away. Auron led Laura by the hand through the darkness, Jor in the lead, and the groggy Terran behind, the other woman carrying something bulky that bumped against her shoulder as she ran. The winds were rising higher by the second, but over them the surf slamming against the cliff walls filled Laura's ears, and her heart thundered riotously, knowing they intended to sail upon it. Sweat rolled in beads down her back as they reached the clifftops overlooking the sea, nothing visible in the blackness, the moon and stars obscured by clouds. It began to rain. A cold drizzle that soaked her hair and trickled down the back of her tunic as she watched the soldiers stationed on the island strain to lift what appeared to be an enormous wooden ladder up into the air. The end of it was attached to ropes, and it took 8 of them to lower it over the edge of the cliff into the darkness below.
"There's a large rock outcropping below,"
Auron shouted into her ear.
"We'll climb down and wade over to the islet where we have the boats moored. It's low tide, but the water will still be up to your knees." "Let's go!"
Jor was on the ladder and climbing down toward the crashing sea below, Leah following him.
"I'll go first, then you, then Terran."
Laura nodded wordlessly, unable to speak around the chatter of her teeth. Auron swung onto the ladder and clambered down. But when Laura gripped the rungs, her fingers felt numb. Her arms and legs trembled, and it took all her willpower to descend. Down and down toward the water. "If they can do it, so can you." She repeated the chant, her lips moving silently, her hands slick with sweat, spray drenching her clothes as wave after wave hammered the outcropping below. Finally, Auron's hands closed around her waist, steadying her as she stepped onto the slimy rocks. Terran was down a moment later, and when she gave the call, there was a creak as the soldiers lifted the ladder back onto the island. Laura could see nothing, nothing, but all around her, water roared. One step in the wrong direction, and she was done for. The thought had her dropping to her knees, her fingers clutching at the rocks.
"We don't have time for you to crawl. We'll be in a far worse spot if we're stuck out here when the tide turns."
Her knees trembled as she rose, her breath coming in great, gasping whooshes as she took one step, then two, allowing Auron to guide her.
"Jor's marked the path."
Auron lifted her hand, using it to point, because she couldn't so much as see his outline in the blackness. "There." Smears of glowing algae were faintly visible every few paces. Her heart steadied and she pressed forward, her confidence growing with each step.
"There's about a 10-foot stretch here that's submerged. You'll be up to your knees, but the current is strong, so hold on to me."
"Damn you for making me do this." Auron laughed, which pissed her off enough to take the first step. Laura's boot filled with water, the current shoving against her leg, then dragging her in the opposite direction as it surged. She clung to Auron's belt, feeling Terran's steadying hand on her shoulder from behind. Step. Step. Her toe caught on a rock, and Laura stumbled, a sob tearing from her throat as she caught her balance. Step. Step. A large wave surged against her, and she slid sideways, her legs washing out from under her. She was up to her waist in water, only her grip on Auron's belt keeping her upright. Her scream cut the night, frantic and desperate and primal. Then his hands closed around her arms, dragging her from the water.
"You're out. It's all right. Worst is over."
"The second I'm on dry land, I'm going to gut you like a pig." She hated being afraid, and the only thing strong enough to chase the emotion away was anger. "I am going to smother you in your sleep." A dozen voices laughed. Jor's voice, the loudest of them all.
"And she finally shows her true intentions.
You might want to curb your vitriol until you're in a place where I can't pick you up and toss you into the drink."
Then Auron stomped to the far side of the islet. Terran's hand caught her elbow, helping her up. "It will only take us an hour to get to midwatch." She pressed a strap into Laura's hand. "I had one of the villagers make this for you. If something happens, it will keep you afloat until one of us can get you back in the boat." Laura ran her hands along the object, which was a looped strap secured to a cask. A small act, but an enormous kindness. And one Laura didn't deserve.
"Thank you."
The Ithaconians deposited her in one of the boats, and she cowered there, clinging with one hand to her cask and the other to the edge as they pushed out into the water. Their voices were unconcerned, despite this being madness that no sane individual would undertake under any circumstances. The boat rose and fell on waves, and her stomach did the same. But Laura couldn't let go long enough to dig the root Nana had given her out of her pocket. She was busy puking over the edge when the group went silent, their hands still on ropes and rudders and lines. "There they are," Leah's voice. Jor cursed under his breath.
"I hope this storm turns nasty and puts them at the bottom of the sea."
Lifting her head, Laura stared blearily out over the water. Bobbing in the distance were dozens, no, hundreds of lights. And carrying on the wind toward them was the sound of music and singing voices. Ships. The Amaridian fleet. "We should go light a few of them up," Leah snapped. "That would put a damper on their party." As one, all heads turned in Oren's direction. Fingernails digging into the edge of the boat, Laura waited to see how he would respond.
"Keep on to mid-watch."
"But we could sink a few of them," Leah argued. "We have the supplies."
"Mid-watch," Oren repeated. "They haven't attacked, and we do not instigate."
"But they will. You know as soon as the weather turns, they'll raid."
"When they do, we'll fight them, same as always."
There was no emotion in Oren's voice, but Laura could feel frustration and anger coming off him in waves.
"Or we could stop them now." Leah was not giving up.
"They're outside our waters, and they've shown no aggression."
Oren shifted restlessly, his knee brushing against Laura's back.
"If we attack unprovoked, Amarid will have cause to declare war on us. This is a few ships. A raid, we can deal with that. The full force of Amarid's navy against us is quite a different matter. Ithacana does not instigate conflict. We can't afford to. Now get us back to mid-watch."
Wordlessly, everyone began to move and the boats regained their speed, skipping across the waves. Yet Laura couldn't tear her gaze from the fading light of the fleet, her father's speech from that fateful dinner shifting and rattling through her head.
"For as long as memory, Ithacana has placed a stranglehold on trade, making kingdoms and breaking them like it were some dark god."
She'd believed that, believed him without question. Yet Oren's words, they weren't those of a ruler with godlike power. Quite the opposite. They were the words of a leader of a kingdom fighting to survive.
Oren rubbed his eyes, which felt like they'd been filled with sand and then left to bake in the summer sun for a week. His ribs throbbed, his back ached, and his palms were marked with blisters from too many days of overuse. The worst was the tooth he was fairly certain had been knocked loose when Laura had accidentally smacked him in the face after she'd been almost swept into the ocean. He prayed it resolved itself, or Nana would never let him hear the end of it.
"We're as ready as we can be."
Jor drank deeply from a silver flask he took from a pocket before passing it across the fire pit to his king.
"You look like you need this."
He probably did need it, but Oren waved the flask away. His team, the green-faced Laura in tow, had returned to mid-watch just prior to dawn, and the entire day had been spent in preparation for the inevitable Amaridian attack. Now there was little to do but watch the weather. With the winds still high, the raiders would be unlikely to attempt a landing, but a light squall like this one wouldn't last, and it certainly wouldn't be enough to drive the ships back to the safety of Amaridian harbors.
"I'm going to take the next patrol."
Jor lifted one eyebrow.
"You already did your shift. I need to move. You know the sitting drives me to madness. It's a cold rain. You'll be regretting your decision halfway around the island."
"Regret," Oren picked up his cloak, "is currently my middle name."
"You're particularly whiny tonight." Scratching his cheek with his middle finger, Arin lifted a hand to acknowledge the soldier who'd just come in from walking the perimeter, then started to the door.
Might as well go with you, just in case you give up halfway and run to the comfort of the fancy house.
I wouldn't count on it. The driving rain was, in fact, freezing, the wind tearing at the hood of Arin's cloak until he gave up on covering his head. They walked in silence for a long time, more focused on keeping their footing on the slick rocks and mud as they traversed the cliffs overlooking the sea. More than a few soldiers had fallen to their deaths, and despite the series of shitty days he'd had, Arin didn't care to join their ranks. When they reached the first lookout, both of them casting their eyes out over the storm-tossed waters, Jor finally said,
"You were right to stand your ground with them yesterday."
"Maybe." Arin's thoughts drifted to the meeting at Arinol, to the hard faces of his watch commanders as they had arrived, weaving their way through the evacuees disembarking from their ships, supplies and crying children everywhere. "Most disorganized evacuation in recent history," he'd heard muttered more times than he could count. He was inclined to agree with the sentiment.
"It's the Council's duty to question you. They pushed your mother constantly, especially about this. She learned to know when they were giving good advice and when it was their fear talking, when to stand her ground and when to concede."
Arin extracted his spyglass, panning the blackness for any lights on the horizon marking a ship.
"You think I was right to stand my ground on this?"
The only sound was the wind howling and the waves slamming against the cliffs below.
"I don't know. I'm not sure there is a right choice in this, Arin. All paths lead to war."
He leaned back on his hands.
"But what's done is done, at least so far as the battle facing us is concerned. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to take a piss."
The older man silently disappeared into the jungle and then, not so silently, did his business, Arin remaining crouched on the rocks, shoving his hands in his pockets to warm them. With the evacuation mostly complete, his people had answered the annual call to arms, everyone between 15 and 50 either at or on their way to their assigned garrison, the only exception families with small children, who only sent one parent. Able bodies fought. Those unable played other roles, whether it be watch duties, dispatching signals, organizing supply drops, or managing the complex task of ensuring every one of the hundreds of outposts were appropriately manned. Ithacana didn't have civilians during war tides. It had an army. An army that was furious that Amarade had caught them with their trousers down at Sereth, an island that just happened to be under Arin's watch. Over and over he replayed the War Tides Council meeting in his head, seeing 100 things he could have done differently, said differently. "I understand you took heavy losses at Sereth, Your Grace," Watch Commander Mara's voice echoed in his head. "That's twice Amarid has sneaked up on you and War Tides has only just begun. The pretty Maradrinian girl must be quite distracting." Everyone in the room had shifted uneasily. Laura, the crux of the barb, not the losses. Everyone there knew that Sereth was a nightmare to defend, the proximity of the bridge to the beach making it impossible to use shipbreakers as vessels could hide in its shadow while launching landing craft. It took manpower and preparation to hold off an attack, and even then, with heavy fog, the soldiers stationed there would only have had the few minutes it took the longboats to reach the beach to mount their defense, which would have been enough if the man on watch hadn't fallen asleep at his post, a mistake the soldier had paid for with his life. "I understand she was with you when the attack happened? In the bridge?" There'd been no hope of keeping that quiet, not with all the evacuees from Sereth now in Arinol. Gossip moved faster than a tempest in Ithacana. The only saving grace was that Aster was late to the meeting. If the watch commander knew what Laura had seen, the old bastard would burst a blood vessel.
"It's never been my intention to keep Laura locked up. You all know that."
Yet neither had it been his intention to bring her into the bridge or for her to see how his military used it to fight their enemies. But watching her panic in the boat, gasping for breath and shaking uncontrollably, he hadn't been able to take it. He wasn't about to admit that in front of these battle-hardened men and women whose respect he needed to earn. Knowing your intentions isn't the same as agreeing with them. The Maradrenians are rats. Let one loose and soon all of Ithacana will be infested with them. The Maradrenians are our allies, Anna said from where she stood at the far end of the large replica of Ithacana, her hand resting protectively on Southwatch Island. Mara made a face. The Maradrenians are our business partners at best, Anna. We pay them for peace. That's not an alliance. But it could be, Arin thought before he interjected. They gave us 15 years of peace in exchange for nothing, Mara. They proved their commitment to the treaty, and now it's time for us to do the same. But at what cost? Mara gestured to the middle of the map, where model Amaridian ships sat to represent the lurking enemy fleet. The Amaridians were always Ithacana's worst raiders, primarily because they were competitors for the same business, trade between the continents. Amaridian merchant vessels took the greatest risks, making the crossing north and south even during storm season, primarily trafficking goods Ithacana wanted no part of in its markets. Maradrina had made heavy use of their services. Until now. And the Amaridian queen clearly intended to make her displeasure over that fact known. Once terms are negotiated with Herondale, they'll check Amarid's navy. For while Amarid might risk quarreling with Ithacana, picking battles with their enormous neighbor was another thing entirely. Has Herondale sent for Anna yet? Arin sensed his twin shifting nervously behind him. No. Begun trade negotiations? Not yet. Sweat dribbled down Arin's back, and it was a struggle not to grind his teeth. Which isn't surprising. They'll be waiting to see how the peace stands in the south before they start making demands.
Doesn't smell like peace.
Everyone turned to watch Commander Astor enter the room.
Smells to me like war.
He handed Arin a folded letter sealed with amethyst-colored wax stamped with the Valakotan emblem of crossed staffs.
Ran into the mail runner in the bridge and thought to bring this to you directly.
You mean you thought to have me read it in front of everyone? Arin thought, cracking the wax with more force than was necessary, reading the few lines and struggling to keep a grimace from his face as he set the page down on the replica of Midwatch. The Empress of Valkata was a reasonable woman. The Valkatans were reasonable people. But both hated Maradrina in a way that bordered on religion. It was a sentiment that the Maradrinians returned. Well, Mara demanded at the same time Astor blurted out,
has Valkata declared war on us?
Eyes on the page, Arin read, to His Royal Majesty, King Arin Curtel, King of Ithacana, ruler of the Tempest Seas, and master of the bridge. Everyone in the room seemed to hold their breath, and he knew why. Until today, the Empress had always addressed him as Dearest Arin, beloved son of my friend, God keep her soul in peace. The use of his titles was not a good sign. He continued,
long have Valkata and Ithacana been friends.
Friends who raid when the weather's nice, Jor muttered from where he stood at Arin's left.
All friends quarrel on occasion, Astor said. Will you continue, Your Grace?
Long have Valkata and Ithacana been friends, and it grieves us terribly to learn that you have chosen to betray that friendship by siding with Maradrina against us. Someone in the room let out a low whistle, but Arin didn't lift his head from the page. It breaks our heart to know that our dear friend Ithacana now supplies our mortal enemy in their unjust attacks against our lands, and all our dead we shall lay at your feet.
No one spoke.
Strong is our desire to maintain our friendship with Ithacana, but this affront cannot go unanswered. Once the calm is upon us, we shall deploy our fleets to blockade our foe, Maradrina, from reaching your markets at Southwatch Island until this offensive alliance is broken. He was prevented from reading the rest as both Aster and Mara broke into laughter, much of the room echoing them.
Good fortune favors us after all, Aster finally managed to get out. Silas thought he was so clever, thought he'd managed to extract the one thing from us that we didn't want to give, but neither he nor Maradrina will see any of it.
Auron hadn't laughed then, and he certainly wasn't laughing now. A twig snapped, and he jerked from his thoughts, turning to watch Jor step back out onto the rocks, still in the process of buckling his belt.
Winds are strengthening. Storm is going to rage harder before it gives its last gasp. Amarid will have to cool its heels for a few days before they come for blood.
The old soldier smirked at Auron.
It's an opportune moment for you to go spend some time with that pretty wife of yours. She's starting to take a shine to you, I can tell.
You came to all those realizations while you were taking a shit?
It's when I do my best thinking. Now go. I'll finish the patrol.
Rising to his feet, Auron cast his gaze in the direction of his house, then shook his head. Laura was supposed to be the first step toward a better future for Ithacana. But with Amarid about to wage war and Valcata doing its best to destroy the treaty, a better future no longer felt like a dream. It felt like a delusion.
Laura rested her chin on her forearms, one eye on the faint glow in the east, and the other on the Ithacanians, grouped in the clearing in front of the barracks. Rainwater dripped down the back of her neck, but after 3 nights spent spying from the roof of the large stone structure, she barely noticed the endless damp anymore. The population of Midwatch had grown by 4, if not 5 times in the past few days, men and women arriving by boat to join the ranks. They were civilians, or at least had been, until war tides began. But calling them such seemed a misnomer. As they fell into the efficient routine of Midwatch, with practiced ease, even the youngest, who couldn't have been more than 15, seemed to have arrived fully trained. Still, the ranking officers, who were all career soldiers at Midwatch, ran them through drill after drill, day and night, leaving nothing to chance. And anything that happened in the midnight hours, Laura was witness to. Sneaking out of the Midwatch house was no great challenge, despite the number of guards Auron now had posted around the home. For one, she'd earned a bit of trust from them by saving Auron's life during the battle on Sereth Island, so they were no longer waiting for her to do something nefarious. Two, the clouds from the rainstorms made for the darkest of nights, giving her perfect cover for escape. And three, the Ithacanians were distracted by what they perceived as a far greater threat than a young woman soaking herself in a hot spring. The Amaridians. The fleet remained off the coast of Ithacana, though there had been no attack since Sereth. Eli, the source of much of Laura's information, had told her that they were unlikely to make a move until the weather had cleared. The waters were shallow and full of rocks and shoals, as well as the man-made defenses Ithacana was known for, and unpredictable winds and poor visibility made attacking during foul weather inadvisable. But the storm wouldn't last forever, and Midwatch seethed with anticipation of the battles to come, which served Laura's purpose as well. Already her head was full with what she had learned during her venture off Midwatch with Auron, and the past 3 nights had yielded even more. From her perch, she'd learned much about how the bridge was patrolled, inside and out, where sentries were stationed on the surrounding islands, and the signals they used to communicate with Midwatch, which seemed to function as a central control point for this area of Ithacana. She'd learned about the explosives they'd used to destroy enemy ships, shot by arrow or launched by shipbreaker, and, if the story she'd overheard was true, occasionally planted by hand under the cover of night. She'd watched them train, working in the rain with only faint lantern light so as not to draw the attention of anyone on the water. Hand to hand, with blades and with bow, the worst of them were at least proficient. The best of them, well, she wouldn't want to go up against the best of them unless she had to. Their weapons were all of fine make, every one of them armed to the teeth, the garrison stockpiled with enough to supply them with spares. Midwatch was only one piece of the puzzle. But if it was the standard that Ithacana held itself to, then what Saren and the rest of her masters had told Laura and her sisters about Ithacana being impenetrable had been alarmingly accurate. But as to the rest of what she and her sisters had been told about Ithacana, that Laura was questioning. Questioning what was truth and what was lies, because it was impossible that all parties had been honest with her, not with everyone claiming to be the victim, and no one the aggressor. Someone was deceiving her. Or everyone was. Pushing a strand of wet hair back from her face, Laura wished, not for the first time, that she'd been allowed to spend time away from the compound. Everything she knew had come from books and from her masters. Outside of combat, she was like a scholar who studies the world but never leaves the library. It was a limitation, and one she'd pointed out to Saren several times, much to his endless irritation. "It's not worth the risk," he'd snap. "All it would take is one slip on your part, and everything we've worked for, fought for, would be undone. Is your desire for a sojourn worth losing the only chance Moradrina has at slipping Ithacana's yoke?" He'd never waited for a response, only slapped her cheek and said, "Remember your purpose." Master Eric had given her a different answer when she'd pressed. "Your father is a man who needs control, little cockroach," he'd said, passing a whetstone up and down a blade. "Here, he can control every variable, but outside." He used the weapon to gesture to the desert. "True control is beyond even a king's power. Your life is as it is out of necessity, my girl, but it won't be this way forever." His words had infuriated her at the time, a vague non-answer in her childish opinion. But now she wondered if there was more depth to his response than she'd once realized. Now she wondered if the variable her father had most wanted to control was her. The main door to the barracks opened and shut behind her, and Laura's attention perked as a tall figure exited the building. He had his hood pulled up against the rain, clothing identical to that of every other soldier, but she knew instinctively it was Auron. Something about his stride, the way he held his shoulders, the hint of pride that radiated from him as he surveyed the troops, and something else that she couldn't quite put a finger on. She knew that what her father and Saren had told her about the King of Ithacana had been a lie, though she understood why. It was easier to stab a demon in the back, a much harder thing to betray a man whose actions and choices were driven by a desire to do right by his people. But she also knew that her homeland and Ithacana were at odds, and what would save one would damn the other. The welfare of her people was her priority, her mission to give them the one thing that would ensure their future. And for that reason, Auron could never be anything to her but the enemy. Auron stepped closer to the training soldiers to say something to the woman leading the exercises, and Laura leaned forward to catch what it was. When she did, a piece of debris slipped off the roof of the barracks, landing with a soft thud on the ground. Auron turned on his heel, one hand going to the weapon belted at his waist, the other shoving back his hood. Laura froze. Dressed in black clothes, she was hidden in the darkness atop the roof, unless someone held up a lantern to investigate a noise. With the toe of his boot, Auron nudged the fallen bit of branch and leaves. Laura silently willed him to look away. "It's nothing, just foliage knocked loose by the wind. Happens 100 times a day. But even as she did, she could relate to the sixth sense that was telling him something wasn't right.
"Someone bring a lantern over here. And a ladder. I think we've got snakes on the roof again."
Pulse roaring in her ears, Laura eased back, her fingers clutching the slimy stone of her perch. He'd hear even the slightest noise, but if she didn't move fast. A horn sounded in the distance, and the Ithacanians, Auron included, stopped what they were doing and turned in the direction of the water. Another horn sounded, this one closer, and Auron gave a sharp nod.
"Our Meridians are on the move."
He started shouting out orders, but Laura couldn't afford to stay to listen. Dawn was approaching, and she needed the cover of night to get back into the house undetected. And she needed to be in-house by the time the sun was up, or her absence would be noted. Easing around the back of the barracks, she jumped, catching hold of a tree branch that really needed to be cut back. From tree to tree, she climbed, then dropped into the shelter of the jungle. Using the route she'd established on her first night, she cut over to the path leading up to the house, moving as fast as she dared on the muddy earth. Gorik and Leah were guarding the exterior, and she silently circled until she found a place out of sight of both of them, then scaled the wall, crawled over the roof, and dropped into the courtyard. Easing inside through her cracked window, she swiftly scrubbed the mud from her boots and clothes, putting everything back in the wardrobe where it could dry undetected. A knock sounded at the door, the lock rattling. "Your Grace, it's Dawn." "Taryn." The woman was like damned clockwork. Since her perceived failure to watch Laura while they were staying at Nana's house, Taryn was intent on redeeming herself by monitoring Laura like a hawk. She slept in the hall outside Laura's door. Would have slept right next to her damned bed if Laura hadn't gently noted that Taryn's snoring rivaled the thunderstorms for volume. If she didn't answer, Taryn would likely break down the door. "Coming." Throwing on a robe and wrapping a towel around her hair, Laura trotted across the floor and opened the door. "Is something wrong? I heard horns." "Amarid." Taryn narrowed her eyes. "Why is there mud on your face?" "I was just washing it off. Certain muds are good for the skin. They cleanse the pores." "Mud?" Taryn gave her a dubious frown, then shook her head, passing a weary hand over her eyes before stepping into the room, giving it a once-over. "I've told you not to leave your window open. You're asking to wake up with a snake under the covers with you." "I only opened it just now," Laura lied. "It was stuffy in here." Taryn checked under the bed. "The storm's blown over, so you can go outside if you want fresh air." Then she flipped back the cover and swore, stepping back several paces. "What did I tell you?" A small snake, black with yellow bands, was coiled in the center of the bed, hissing angrily at them. Muttering under her breath, Taryn stepped in the hallway and shouted for Eli, who appeared moments later, a long stick with a loop of rope at one end. He deftly caught the creature, the loop tightening around its neck, then departed as quickly as he'd come, snake in tow. Apparently, Laura needed to add, "check room for snakes" to her routine when returning from a reconnaissance mission. Though there wasn't much more to be gained from the roof of the barracks. Or from midwatch, for that matter. It was a nearly impossible nut to crack, unless her father could get someone on the inside. Ideally, that would be her, but she fully intended to be long gone before Maradrina invaded. Her life as much in danger from her father's soldiers as it would be from the Ithacanians, once they realized she'd betrayed them. Which meant she needed to find an entry point other than midwatch for her father to exploit. "I'm going to nail your window shut." Taryn stepped aside so that Eli's aunt could enter with the breakfast tray, which was deposited on the small table. "Or else start locking Vitex in here with you at night." The thought of sleeping with the enormous cat watching gave Laura the shivers. "I'll keep it shut, I promise." Sitting at the table, Laura loaded two plates full of food and then gestured at the other woman to join her, both of them drinking deeply from their steaming coffees. They'd grown increasingly familiar in their time together, Taryn easy to be around in a way that reminded Laura of her sisters. "Has Amarid attacked?" "Not yet. They know they no longer have the element of surprise, so they'll look for points of weakness."
"Is Auron?"
"He'll be on the water, making sure we have no points of weakness." "Why?" Taryn smirked. "Miss him." Laura gave a snort of amusement that could be taken either way, but the wheels were turning in her head. Auron gone meant there was no one on midwatch to tell her no. "I wanted to ask him something."
"Oh?
I want to get used to being on the water." Taryn paused in her chewing of a mouthful of ham, then swallowed.
Wartides isn't exactly the ideal time for sailing aimlessly about, Laura.
Laura gave her a gentle kick under the table.
I know that. I was thinking I could sit in a boat in the cove. Then perhaps by the end of Wartides, I'll have adjusted to the water enough that I might venture further without subjecting everyone to my vomiting.
Taryn took another bite of meat, her brow furrowed.
There's a lot of coming and goings right now.
Is there another location that would work better? I don't want to be in the way. And if there was another landing point on the island, perhaps one with fewer defenses, it might mitigate her need to find another entrance to the bridge.
Nowhere with a proper beach.
Laura exhaled a long breath of disappointment. It's only that I feel so trapped. I want to see more of Ithacana, but with my seasickness and my fear, it seems impossible.
Trapped the way Taryn felt trapped, limited in where she might go and what she might do by circumstance and necessity.
Laura watched her words strike home, the other woman setting down her fork, eyes distant as she thought.
I suppose we could try it for an hour and see if anyone takes issue.
Laura grinned. Let me wash the rest of this mud off my face, and then we can go.
3 hours later, the two of them sat in a bobbing canoe, Laura trying to keep track of the goings-on in the cove while periodically leaning over the side to empty her guts.
Taryn had taken her to another building not far from the barracks, which was filled with a variety of vessels that weren't currently in use. She had selected a small canoe that wouldn't fit more than the two of them, so old it barely appeared seaworthy. No one would miss this particular vessel. As they carried it down to the beach, Laura silently considered how she might secret it away for her eventual escape. She rested her forearms on the edge of the canoe and watched the chain guarding the mouth to the cove rise so that vessels could ferry goods from the pier to the shore. Crates of food, supplies, and weapons, all hailing from Herondale. There were cages of clucking chickens, 3 live pigs, and a dozen sides of beef, the Ithacanians' movements concealed by heavy mist. The signal horns never seemed to cease their blowing, ripples of sound that conveyed countless different messages, judging from the various reactions they incited, and not something that could be mimicked by an untrained Maradrinian soldier. Laura suspected her father would need to enlist musicians should he wish to turn the form of communication to his advantage. Taking a sip from a canteen of water, Laura rubbed her throbbing temple as she listened to the notes, attempting to memorize patterns and responses, though it would take days, probably weeks of listening and watching for her to make any meaningful sense of them. The canoe had swung around so she was facing away from the cliffs guarding the cove from the sea, but the rattle of chain caught her attention and she turned to watch a series of vessels enter, her eyes immediately finding Auron in one of them, and his finding her. She watched him exchange words with Jor, and then the vessel altered its course from the beach to Laura's little canoe. Standing, he held onto the mast as the two boats came alongside.
I suppose there's an interesting explanation for this.
Taryn rose, the canoe rocking, and Laura's stomach rocked along with it. Her grace is of the opinion that exposure will cure her seasickness.
How's that working out?
Taryn gestured at the school of tiny fishes circling the boat, and Laura felt her cheeks warm as they both laughed at her expense.
Go get some rest, Taryn. I'll take over for a bit.
Laura's heart skipped as Auron settled on the seat facing Laura. He waited until the other boat was nearly to the beach before asking,
Why exactly have you volunteered yourself for this particular misery?
Laura stared at the bottom of the canoe, which was taking on a bit of water through a tiny crack that she'd need patch.
Because if I don't learn to master the sea, I'll never be able to go anywhere with you.
Master?
He leaned forward, and her eyes of their own accord fixed on his lips, heat rising to her cheeks as she remembered the feel of them against her own.
Perhaps tolerate is a better word.
She noticed a nasty scrape on the inside of his forearm.
You're hurt.
It's nothing. I had an altercation with a rock, and the rock came out better in the exchange.
Part of her was afraid to move closer to him, already aware that in his presence, she'd stopped seeing and hearing what was going on around them. but she told herself he was also the key to seeing more of Ithacana, and that was a necessary part of her plan. Let me have a look. He shifted nearer, unbuckling the greave that protected the backside of his arm.
See? Nothing of consequence.